Good morning. May it please the Court. Justice Gibson in absentia, but here via phone. My name is Jeffrey Dickerson. I'm from Reno, Nevada. I represent the appellant in this case, Mr. Bankston, who is a federal employee who was dismissed from federal service, after which he filed an appeal with the MSPB. He also alleged that age discrimination was involved with his termination, and therefore it became a mixed case with the MSPB. Prior to the administrative hearing with the ALJ, he withdrew his or requested withdrawal of his MSPB, doing that directly to the ALJ, who in turn granted that request, allowed the withdrawal, and canceled the hearing, whereupon Mr. Bankston proceeded to file in a timely fashion, in other words, within 90 days, in Federal District Court in Reno, Nevada. What ensued was a motion to dismiss initially on that case, which we'll call Bankston 1, in which they moved to dismiss based upon a failure to exhaust grounds. That culminated in a colloquy between counsel and the court, whereupon Judge McKibben ordered us to have 90 days in which to attempt to reopen that matter and then come back to him if advise him if we had been able to reopen it. If we couldn't reopen it, then he'd address the issue that was presented at that point in time. We attempted to reopen it. The MSPB would not allow us to reopen it, so we did come back to Judge McKibben, and the issue was again presented. The procedural posture within which it was presented happened to be a renewed action because he dismissed the previous action without prejudice to bring a second action, and there was no issue regarding limitations periods due to that order. The district court considered the new briefing, did not have, I don't believe, subsequent arguments. I'm sure that the district court considered the transcript because it ordered the transcript on the previous hearing, and then made a decision. And the decision was not based upon, nor did it address, the question that was left open in Stevens versus the Department of Treasury. And that question is whether or not, under the ADEA, a federal employee is required to exhaust his administrative remedies. Our position in this appeal and down below was that, as Justice Stevens, in his concurring opinion, indicated, that there was no exhaustion requirement in the ADEA, and therefore, a fortiori, you could not have an abandonment argument to apply as a prudential consideration by the courts, grafting something into the legislation that wasn't there. Administratively, you may have regulations under these cases that address this issue, and under the regulation that was addressed below by Judge McKibben, which is 29 CFR 1614, that's a regulation. And Judge McKibben solely addressed the regulation. He did not address whether or not the ADEA, the statute that Congress created this remedy under, addressed whether or not a final agency decision was necessary in order to proceed to federal court. And as indicated in Justice Stevens' concurring opinion in Stevens versus the Department of Treasury, what the courts that have gone this way, the Third Circuit, the First Circuit in Castro, the Third Circuit in Petrel, these other cases that have been cited in the briefs and in the decision below, have grafted upon this statutory scheme an analogy, or by analogy, a requirement similar to that in Title VII, where there is none that exists. And the only circuit that's out there that really has candidly addressed this issue, I think, is the Sixth Circuit in Langford. And they looked at it and they said there is nothing there to require a final agency decision under the ADEA.
Does it make a difference if the action is still pending at the time that the civil action is brought?
That issue isn't here, thank goodness, because in the back decision, which they argue is not applicable anymore, but there is a part in that back decision at the very last paragraph. They say that the primary purpose of the exhaustion requirement is to prevent simultaneous proceedings. And I would imagine that if that issue were presented to you, you would have some serious prudential concerns because you're double tracking it. And in that instance, it's not here, though. Fortunately for this Court, it doesn't have to address that issue. That would raise some serious concerns prudentially. In this case,
EEOC there was, as I recall, there was in the earlier I forget the date it was amended, but it was amended so that if the petitioner filed or the claimant filed a civil action, that automatically terminated the pending proceeding?
Right. Yeah. And in this particular case. For instance, in the Vinietros case, which is a Ninth Circuit case where they applied the abandonment doctrine, and that case doesn't apply here. I mean, that case, you've got that guy going every which way but loose, Your Honor. You know, he files an MSPB, then he files an EEOC, and he does several other things before he finally gets to federal court. But in that case, what happened was he filed with the MSPB and then filed with the EEOC, and you can't have both. And so that's another situation where you would have some serious prudential considerations at play, where you've got a complaining party, a charging party, attempting to dual-track things and get two bites at the apple, essentially. We didn't get two bites at the apple here. We decided, when I got involved with the case, and I don't know if this is in the record, but just so you know, I became involved, and I did not want to go to that hearing. I did not want this adjudicated by the administrative law judge, and I advised the client that we could get out of this. I reviewed the case law with respect to this, and I knew this issue was going to come up. I was almost certain that it was going to come up, and here we are today addressing it. We're not addressing it because I'm concerned about my potential problem in advising the client to drop that. We're addressing this because it's an important issue. And the question, I think, really comes down to, can this court look, as the court below did, look at a regulation that the EEOC has promulgated that says here are the three avenues you have to go, and you can't go to federal court until 180 days expires in the EEOC process or 120 days expires with the MSPB process, and then you can treat that as a final agency decision, and only then can you go to federal court where the Congress has not imposed any such limitation. Where Congress has imposed such a limitation, the courts have been correct in coming down and applying as a prudential consideration the requirement that if you undertake to exhaust your administrative remedies and abandon them, you're stuck. But in this situation, you don't have that. And therefore, by imposing that prudential consideration in this case, under these facts, this Court is grafting a prudential requirement or a limitation where Congress has not even spoke or spoken. And I think that would be inappropriate for this Court to undertake that type of judicial legislating where Congress has been silent. And we know that where Congress has wanted to speak about the issue, it has done so. It has done so very clearly under 2000E16, Title VII, requiring exhaustion, requiring a final agency decision to be made before you proceed to federal court. It has not done so in the ADEA, and certainly not with respect to federal employees.
You say that Judge McKibben relied on regulation. What does the regulation say about that?
Well, as I recall the regulation, it's somewhat detailed, but it says that you can, as a federal employee.
Oh, on this particular issue, we don't have to get into all the detail.
Oh, okay. On this particular issue?
Yeah.
Well, Judge McKibben canvassed it in a long paragraph as to what the different options were, what he did here, which is basically took the third option, went to the MSPB, and under the MSPB category, you've got 120 days. They have 120 days to deal with the issue, after which you can treat it as a final agency decision. Here on the 62nd day, we withdrew. Okay, so we didn't exhaust the 120. But I think it's curious, if you look at, I believe, footnote 11, I saw this morning and thought it was curious, that in the Vinietros case at footnote 11, they discussed the 120-day MSPB requirement because, remember, in that case, he had gone to the MSPB. And in the footnote, the court notes that the 120-day limitation is a fire under the agency's rear, if you will, and not any kind of effect upon a final agency decision. As I understand that footnote, what they're saying is, unlike the 180-day requirement the EEOC has imposed, after which you can treat it as a final agency decision, the Vinietros case is saying that's not what that is. 120 days does not make a final agency decision. Okay? So that's another distinction, and I haven't thought through how to, if it's even necessary, to try to figure that out, because, again, Congress has not required a final agency decision. Whether or not the 120 is a final agency decision or not is beside the point in this case. We did undertake in a timely fashion to trigger the procedures that were in place as Congress has required. We timely filed the action after concluding the administrative proceeding, and to say that we abandoned that proceeding and therefore didn't exhaust leaves this person without a remedy, and that's unfair, and it's not what Congress intended. Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay. Judge Gibson, any questions?
No questions.
All right.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
My name is Greg Addington. I'm an assistant United States attorney for the District of Nevada in Reno. It would be very tempting to read the Supreme Court decision in Stevens and this Court's decision in Back and conclude that an age discrimination complainant need not proceed through any previously initiated administrative process before filing suit in district court. I would submit that that is superficially appealing, but it would be erroneous. There are two separate parallel statutory and regulatory schemes available for an age discrimination complainant. One is under Title 29 and the implementing regulations in 29 CFR, specifically 29 CFR 1614.201 and following. And on the other hand, there is another track under Title 5. The Title 29 process is described as the EEO process. Another process is the MSPB process under Title 5, specifically Section 7702, and its implementing regulations found at 5 CFR, specifically 1201.151 and following. The district court properly recognized that this is that Mr. Bankston initiated a mixed case under Title 5, Section 7702, and its implementing regulations. Neither Stevens nor Back have anything to do with this case because the complainants in those two cases initiated EEO processes by filing a EEO complaint with their respective agencies. Those are not mixed case cases. Those are not MSPB cases. They are separate and distinct regulations with separate and distinct requirements. And this Court in Back made it very clear in footnote 1 at page 244 of that decision that it had nothing to do with anything other than EEO regulations, namely the Title 29 regulations. In footnote 1, it states, quote, "We emphasize that our holding is limited to age discrimination claims governed by EEOC regulations." And then there's a case citation following. This case, the Bankston case, is not governed by the EEOC regulations. Back recognized, just as the Seventh Circuit in Adler had previously recognized, that the EEOC regulations included a provision which Your Honor Judge Hugg mentioned, namely 29 CFR 1614.409, that filing suit in the EEOC context terminates the commission's processing of the appeal. And I say commission processing of the appeal because that's what the regulation says. It only affects what the EEOC does because it would only be an EEOC matter that was pending in connection with those regulations.
Well, so the EEOC regimen is that, and that Back was dealing with, now provides that if to the result of Regulation 1613.513 in effect at the time Back filed his complaint is to terminate any unexhausted administrative proceeding when a claimant files a civil suit. Similarly, an exhaustion requirement would terminate any civil suit filed. Thus, the joint effect of the amended regulations and exhaustion would be to leave the claimant without any avenue of relief.
That is correct.
Okay, so in the EEOC process, if the claimant terminates, if the claimant files a parallel civil action, doesn't that terminate by the claimant's act?
Yes.
Okay, so in this case, the claimant effectively did just that. The claimant withdrew his claim before the MSPB.
He did.
Now, where is it writ that the claimant, having started down the MSPB road, must finish it to conclusion when the MSPB, in fact, granted his request to dismiss?
Yes. Well, first of all, we must note that under the Title V regime and the 5 CFR regime pertinent to mixed cases,
right,
there is no counterpart to the regulation in the EEOC.
Well, but there's also no exhaustion requirement as a counterpart to Title VII, is there?
Yes, indeed there is. Under Title V, 7702.
Title VII has a statutory exhaustion requirement, doesn't it?
Title VII has the statutory exhaustion requirement built into it, yes, sir.
Is there one for MSPB, Title
V? Yes. Title V.
Congress specified exhaustion of remedies.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
And I would note, Title V of 7702 begins with one of my very favorite introductory phrases, notwithstanding any other provision of law, and then it goes on to state that a mixed case complainant who files a petition with the MSPB is before that board, and the board, quote, must decide that appeal within 120 days, or must decide.
What does that say about exhaustion of remedies, though? That's not the, does that parallel the language in Title VII?
Well, it does.
That's what you're reading into, and that's what Judge McKibben understood it to be saying, but that doesn't say anything about that the petitioner, having brought it, must exhaust that. It just says that's a time frame in which MSPB must act.
Yes.
It's sort of like the California Supreme Court has to get its decisions out 60 days in submission or they don't get paid. But that doesn't mean, I mean, that's what you're reading into it, though, that that's a congressional exhaustion requirement.
That is the congressional exhaustion requirement. That's correct. The board must decide the appeal that is presented to the board.
And if they don't, if they don't do it within 120 days, what?
Then the implementing regulations under the 5 CFR state that if the board does not decide within 120 days, the mixed case complainant may proceed to district court.
Well, that's what I say. That's a time limit on, that's a statute of limitations or decisional limitations on MSPB, isn't it? How does that say anything about that the petitioner must, having brought it, bring it, allow the MSPB to make the decision?
Because the board is directed to decide the case that's before it.
Within a time limit.
Within a time limit.
Right.
And if the board does not decide, then the complainant has the choice to proceed to district court. And that is precisely the analysis which this court followed in Vineratos, which, of course, was not an age discrimination case, but was a case that evaluated the MSPB regulations under 5 CFR. Again, a post-Stevens case. And the Vineratos case cited with approval other circuit decisions that were age discrimination cases, that were also mixed case cases. The Third Circuit in Pertil and the Seventh Circuit in McGinty, again, pre-Stevens cases, which may be implicated by the Stevens decision. But following Stevens, the Second Circuit in Economu, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, had before it a mixed case under the Age Discrimination and Employment Act. So it's precisely this type of, and held that the complaint there to the MSPB, and then that withdrew that. At footnote 8, that because, quote, because in the arena before pursuing the Eighth Circuit in McAdams, 1990. And page 1142 of the McAdams Circuit. Chosen that required to exhaust her claim. And continuing, McAdams abandoned her. She had both an ADA discrimination claim as well as a case. So the analysis McAdams
in the circuit.
Regulation CFR regime terminated a process when suit is filed.
When you begin that
to its exhaustion.
But
your argument, I just want to make sure I do that. provision of law that in paragraph and then end of B. Action in accordance with the board's under 70 and this
of MS. Okay,
and then it says what
under paragraph 1 shall be judicial
decision.
The 102 provision that allows the complainant to go to this whole decision made. By. And so it is that two statute for that 120 period of time. An MSPB decision to review sides with the proceed to district court. Thank you.
No questions.
Okay. I'll give you 1 minute.
Apply to decisions, PB. As we withdrew our claim on the 62nd day, we didn't get to the 120. We treated it as a decision. And where there was a hearing, where there was a decision. Of an MSP in this case. The situation left to go back to the ADE and say, did Congress to get any agency decision, whether it's the EE. Your Honor, I think.
Okay, thank you. The case just argued. Admitted. Thank you, counsel, for. Next case under is Biggs v.
May it please McClintock. Whatever questions, but I'll start out by saying this court to that board violated Jeffrey Biggs' due process, have his parole suitability rational that are supported by sufficient evidence, and see that. We are banned the some evidence, some reliable evidence standard.
Address the liberty interest, which suggests, but in that, and we get to the some evidence, why does the support?
Is. The pro forma process letting a governor's policy that repeatedly you read, this is at the excerpts of record page conclusion is title, but the BP. Mr. Letty's declaration, the Board of Prison Terms, Commissioner Ward for no. Experience at the board and what he observed. The board it's well set out there. If there's any about where he says, in no way did they prove that I was unreasonable risk to the public safety.
Again, at page 7,
is the board is going out of its way to make a decision making to make its decision making method vague.
The board have to prove that he would be a danger to society?
I assert that it does. The statutory language is that you will be that you are suitable unless you pose an unreasonable risk of danger. And the language in there is that you've got an expectation of parole and that it's on the board's burden to find, and it's a low threshold. It's still an agency decision. It's just some reliable evidence to show that you pose an unreasonable risk of danger to the public if you're released. So I don't think the board can come into the hearing.
You're entitled to parole unless the parole board prove certain things?
Unless the parole board finds sufficient evidence proves that you pose an unreasonable risk of danger to the public. That's what California law requires. That's what the regulations that implement it say. They set out suitability determination characteristics that they're looking at. So they give them some framework that they work through. And I think that the structure is set up that they're entitled to parole unless the board finds evidence of unsuitability because they're a public danger. It's an unreasonable risk of danger to the public.
At what point? The first year after he's sentenced?
No, I mean, they've got a whole separate structure within the regulations and the statute of when one has an initial suitability hearing. I believe when Mr. Biggs was convicted that it was two-thirds of the minimum term of 25 years plus whatever, given whatever custody credits. I think in his case it was about
25 to life, and this was 15 years along the way, wasn't it?
I think it was 15 years along the way. And then you also have to keep in mind that that if one is found suitable, as McQuillian case is a prime example, he was found suitable for parole in 79, I think, from a early 70s conviction. So it was an even shorter time frame between when the conviction, when he got the CDC, and when he was found suitable. But his release date was decades later. So the separate question of applying the matrix and assessing when he should be released is a separate problem. So the concern that you might be go to prison for a life term, be found suitable a year later, and released 3 weeks later is nowhere in the cards in this case. It's not something you even have to be concerned with. The problem.
What he's asking for is a fixed date.
He's asking for, at this point, he's not even asking for the fixed date in reality. I mean, the limitation of the petition is that he's asking for a fair hearing by a fair board. The fair hearing portion was discussed by the district court.
Let me be sure now, because we've moved from, you know, originally the argument was an attack on some evidence. Now I ask you, okay, why isn't there some evidence? You're saying, well, the thing you'd like to really address is why you didn't, why the district court didn't go into this flap about Governor Davis's alleged per se policy in the Rosencrantz case and so on and so forth. So what is it that you wanted? You say he didn't get a fair hearing, but you haven't addressed why there isn't some evidence. So you're just saying the district court should have determined that this was a bogus hearing, no matter if they said the right kinds of things to satisfy some evidence. The court should look behind it and say, well, they're just doing lip service.
If the district court had found that it was a pro forma hearing, that it was a lip service, then his due process rights would have been violated.
So the answer is yes. So you're saying if there was no evidence that they were just doing lip service, that what they did say would meet the some evidence test?
I'm not conceding that there is some evidence. The problem that I have intellectually analyzing it is there are two separate problems with going straight to the some evidence standard and ignoring everything else that we raised in the brief. One is that the district court didn't have the transcript of the parole hearing. So I think you really have to look at the parole hearing transcript, not just the decisional portion that they had, to assess the sum evidence. And that we put in the brief, and I don't really have anything to add to it. I think that a number of the standards, as the district court found, and even others that it found some evidence for, don't really have some evidence when you look at what was actually said during the hearing. For example, there were some questions about his sincerity or I just blanked it out. Those I don't have anything. I'm not really addressing because I don't have anything to add to what I put in the briefs. The other aspect that I think is problematic is that I don't think the district court can make an accurate sum evidence assessment without calculating into it what evidence there is that the board was biased when it was discussing the evidence.
So your suggestion is that based on these statements of Mr. Biggs pro se on page 20 of his petition, that the district court should have engaged in an examination of Governor Davis's parole policy, basically. Isn't that what that boils down to?
It has to address that issue and what effect that might have had on the board. I'm not relying solely on page 20, but it again shows up in his answer. It again shows up in his objection. So I think the court had notice of it and it just failed to address that issue. I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
You may.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the Court. I'm Deputy Attorney General Jessica Blanion, appearing for appellees. I'm going to jump ahead a little bit right to the question of whether or not there was some evidence, because counsel is just addressing it. And I think it's important for the Court to look at the Penal Code, Section 3041B, where it specifically states that the gravity of the conviction offense, the timing or gravity of the conviction offense, should be considered to determine whether or not public safety requires a more lengthy period of incarceration. I think the board did consider that and found that because of the conviction offense, a more lengthy term of incarceration was warranted. I believe the district court did the same thing, and implicit in that finding, there's a showing that there is some evidence to deny parole, which also is a showing that the decision was not based on bias. Because there's some evidence to support the decision, it's clear that the decision was not made due to a bias of the board.
Just help me understand how this parole process works when they have the first, he's had a second hearing, I guess, as well in the interval, but we're looking at the first hearing, I gather.
Correct.
Okay,
yes.
So when he comes up, what is it that the statute commands, that there be a parole date unless the board finds?
The specific language is the panel or board shall set a release date unless it determines that the gravity of the current convicted offense or offenses.
No, I understand. Okay, so that's, I'm just trying to get, so what the prisoner coming into a parole hearing is looking for is a release date, and it may be a number of years in the future, but it's a target date against which he's now been judged to merit likely parole. Can always be revoked for cause, I gather.
Correct.
And as it was in McQuillian, actually.
Correct. And it's actually two separate decisions. One, whether or not the inmate's suitable for parole, where there's a number of factors that are considered that are laid out in the California Code of Regulations and in the Penal Code. And then the second decision, if they are found suitable, what is the appropriate term?
All right. So in this case, it was suitability?
Correct.
And because of the nature of the offense, that decided he wasn't suitable enough to set a release date?
There were a number of decisions. The nature of the offense was the primary reason. There were also Mr. Biggs's failure to profit from previous terms of probation and parole. He continued his criminality. There was also issues of whether or not further therapy was required.
Did that all, that probation, that was pre-incarceration for this offense, right?
Pre-incarceration for this offense.
So after 15 years in, as a essentially a model prisoner, that's what they were saying, that they were going back to the nature of the offense and what he did during that period when he was 17 and 18?
So that was the primary reason, correct.
Has the California Supreme Court addressed Governor Davis's policy? Didn't the Rosencrantz case
It did. The Rosencrantz case was directly on point, and the evidence that Mr. Biggs submitted with his petition was considered by the court in addition to other evidence. And the Supreme Court found that there was not a blanket parole policy, that the board and the governor did examine each case and consider all the factors. They gave them each individual consideration, which is what was required under the California regulations.
Didn't they also find that there was a liberty interest?
They actually did not address the federal due process standard. They did, though, hold that there was a right to have some procedures and that some evidence was required. That's correct.
All right. So is the state still arguing in this case that we should say there isn't a liberty interest?
Under federal law, we would argue that Sandin should apply, and that given Sandin, you should look for an atypical and significant hardship, and that a life prisoner who goes to a hearing and doesn't receive a date stays in the same position he was as before having the date. And under Sandin, that would not require a due process right.
You don't think McQuillian forecloses that?
McQuillian, I think, is factually different because Mr. McQuillian had a parole date that was rescinded.
What's the substantive difference between the two?
Well,
it said, didn't it read Sandin as being limited to disciplinary cases?
It did,
yeah.
Your Honor, it did. And under Greenholz, I don't think there is a question that a due process right applies.
Okay.
So should the court apply Greenholz, I think that would resolve the issue in line with McQuillian.
All right.
Just turning to the conviction offense and the board's sum evidence finding, the board found that in the commitment offense there was a callous disregard for human suffering and also that the commitment offense was carried out in a dispassionate and calculated manner. Here Mr. Biggs plotted the murder with his co-conspirators. He agreed to transport the murderer to the scene of the crime, which he did. He actually switched out his car so he wouldn't be recognized. He then watched as the victim was bludgeoned and stabbed to death, and then he met his crime partners after the crime where there was an exchange of money. The whole purpose of the murder was to prevent the murder victim from testifying in a crime, and the board properly considered all these factors and weighed them and decided that they presented the sum evidence, the primary reason, to deny Mr. Biggs parole. Unless you have any other questions.
Judge Gibson?
I have no questions.
Okay. Thank you very much.
I just have a few responses. I think you've addressed properly, and she has conceded that Sandin doesn't apply given McQuillian's holding. As far as the last comment she made about the facts, I would only correct that there is no evidence, and the board did not find that Mr. Biggs actually watched the murder. He did aid. He didn't stop it. He did actually bring the person who committed the murder back to more carefully dispose of the body. So he fully admitted to those participations, but he didn't watch.
I'm not hearing you're mumbling.
I'm sorry. I just wanted to clarify a factual assertion she just made about Mr. Biggs having watched the victim being bludgeoned. That did not happen. Mr. Biggs was there, and he admitted, and the board found that he participated as far as transporting the killer, and even worse, in my mind, took the killer back so that the killer could redispose of the body once they found out he'd just been dumped. But he didn't watch the murder, if that makes any difference. The Attorney General's argument regarding
It's clear that he participated in the whole thing.
Right. There's no dispute about it. It's just if that particular factual assertion makes a difference, it's not right.
Do you think it does?
No, but I don't want to leave it dangling there. My only other main significant point is I believe I wrote this down, that she's arguing that bias isn't proof. You can't prove bias by the board if there exists some evidence to support the decision. That just logically doesn't make any sense. You can have a biased decision maker that would undermine someone's due process rights and still have some pieces of evidence that would support it. That doesn't mean the process.
I mean, biased judges can always salt the record.
Right. I could be an ALJ and somewhere saying I hate black people and piecemeal decisions so that I can do that. And that's clearly unconstitutional. His allegation is that the panel was biased.
Whole panel?
Yes.
Okay.
And what is the evidence of that?
The evidence he presented in his petition was the Levy Declaration asserting what Mr. Leddy's, from his experience at the board as a chairman and as a board member.
The same people?
The Leddy Declaration basically says that the governor's policy has had a systemic effect in causing the commissioners not to follow the statutory requirements. So it's a systemic bias that the system has collapsed.
Well, it's a bias of anyone that serves on the parole board because the governor has a policy?
Yes, that the governor's policy has affected in bias their decision-making.
This is the governor who announced that the legislature's duty was to follow his, enact his vision, I think, when he first took office.
The same one. In 99, I believe the governor was, I forgot to write my chronology, I think Pete Wilson was still governor, but the policy has continued. I acknowledge, because you're smiling at me a little bit, that this is a difficult thing for him to prove, but that's not my point at this point. I think it's an issue that needs to be addressed.
We understand what the issue is. Yeah.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you. The case that's argued will be submitted. Next case is Lopez Urenda versus Ashcroft.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
Mark Vanderhoof.
Why don't you let the folks clear out behind you? It's a little cramped here. Okay. Thank you for...
Good morning. Mark Vanderhoof, along with Stephanie Goldsboro from our office on behalf...
Please talk into the mic.
Sorry. On behalf of Mr. Lopez Urenda, who is in court here today, the issue in this case is whether the elimination of suspension of deportation contained in the 96 IRA enactment can be applied retroactively to petitioner, given the unique facts of his particular case. Petitioner applied for asylum on September the 6th, 1996, before IRA and the elimination of suspension and deportation were passed by Congress.
And you're mindful, now you're trying to steer us around Vasquez Zavala.
Correct, Your Honor. It's very distinguishable, and I'll explain why.